Once an unknown territory, crypto and other digital assets have now become part of the fabric of Britain and many local communities, where they're increasingly used in everyday transactions. In the UK, the government has introduced regulations requiring companies to provide data on consumer transactions involving crypto and digital assets, and failure to comply by companies would result in penalties from Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, HMRC. But it raises no doubt a bigger question. Are crypto and digital assets equivalent to real money, or are they just a new frontier for the gambling industry? You may have guessed it. This time on Debt Talk, I'm diving into the world of crypto, digital assets, and gambling. To unpack this complex subject, I'm joined by two distinguished guests. First, Ismail Malik, Executive Chairman of Blockchain Lab and Chief Executive Officer of Infra Staking, which develops digital assets. And finally, Matt Zarb Cousin, co-founder of Gambon, and he is also an avid campaigner. Matt will talk about the relationship between digital finance and gambling harm. So let me start the conversation with Ismail. Ismail, for our Debt Talk listeners, can you explain what crypto and digital assets are and how they're currently being used in the UK market?
Just to iterate, the simplest way to look at a crypto asset is a secure token that's held largely on a blockchain, although it can be held on a private database, usually referred to as a digital ledger. And this token, usually represented in a series of digits and numbers and letters, will be a private key which will entitle you to spend that. It can hold other items, but largely it's been used for holding a value. So it may be, for example, it may hold a Bitcoin or 10 Bitcoins or whatever the number may be, or even a micro amount of Bitcoin. And that will enable you to spend that on a blockchain, which will verify that. So in many essence, it shares the same properties as currency, other than the distinct that it's not held by a bank or a financial institution. It's held on a distributed ledger across multiple computers, and they are the ones that authorize the spending.
How did it come about, and what's the origin behind it?
The origin behind it was a movement called the Cypherpunk movement, which grew out of a group of sort of techno-libertarians who were seeking an alternative to the sort of world domination of the dollar and other currencies, wanting an alternative. There was many attempts, digital gold, etc., etc. And it fast moved post the 2008 financial crisis to what was then termed the Bitcoin blockchain, which resolved what was known as the double spend problem. So if I gave you a asset or a digital token, how can you spend it, and how can someone else not spend it again? This was resolved by a clever sort of mechanism. I won't go into it here because it would take a longer podcast, but essentially it thousands and millions of computers provide proof that that asset exists on a ledger, hasn't been spent, and only the one who's authorized to spend it, aka holds the private keys to that wallet, can actually transact. And then that mushroomed to many others taking that blockchain technology and launching their own currency. So we have the Ethereum, the Litecoin, and now literally thousands and thousands of others that follow very similar principles of the original Bitcoin.
You spoke about crypto on DebtTalk over 2 years ago. How has the landscape changed since then, and what's happening in the terms of regulations and policy framework?
Suppose the biggest change in the last 24 months has been a much more positively aggressive move towards adoption of crypto in the United States and a much more authoritarian clampdown in the UK. So you've seen majority of companies either redomicile to Dubai from the UK or reincorporate or merge or be acquired by US competition.
We know some companies have profited massively earlier on from crypto and other assets. Why was that possible?
It was largely possible for two reasons. One were banks are beholden to the central bank and the regulators, both of which were not keen to give up, the reins of powers or the regulatory watch. So took a really pretty negative and harsh stance. This allowed for a smaller, more nimble players who were able to sort of what we call regulatory arbitrage, move around different jurisdictions, your Bermudas, your Isle of Man, your Gibraltars, and other jurisdictions such as Dubai, and scale and grow outside of the reach of sort of the US and UK and other European regulators.
To model of a business, and how does those businesses, including your own, actually make money?
So largely the businesses make money from transactions. There is, multiple other methods which are a little bit more complicated, such as DeFi, etc. So they would, for example, you wanted to move from one crypto asset to another, you pay a transaction fee, or you wanted to purchase crypto with some, traditional money or some other money, gift cards, etc., and you pay a transaction fee. So the what we call velocity, the more of that those transactions that take place, the more profitable the company.
So where does consumer protection come into play in this scenario, or is there any real protection for everyday investors?
So as it's not, there's no central counterparty, you're largely outside of consumer protection. If you are wanting to deal with something, so you may choose Coinbase, a multi-billion regulated, listed stock exchange company in the US that will then act as your sort of guarantor for the transaction, and therefore you have your traditional consumer protection.
So, how can crypto or other digital assets be quantified in terms of actual investment, or is it just a speculative value?
So I would draw a markation. So currently we have two strands in crypto. So we have purely digital native assets that derive their market value from demand, supply and demand. So very, very uncorrelated to anything else in the market. So your Bitcoin, your Ethereum, and then you have your stable coins, which are pegged. And a lot of those reserves are checked. So you'll have a stable coin, let's say USDC. It $1 will have $1 of value held in custody in a secure environment with a custodian, usually regulated. And those are non-speculative. So you have your speculative kind of Bitcoin, Ethereum, and then you have your fixed crypto assets, your stable coins, USDT, USDC, etc., which are pegged to the US dollar.
So where does non-fungible tokens fit into the discussion then?
Non-fungible tokens were essentially a requirement that came about to create unique tokens. So, for example, if I am wanting to give out 30,000 tokens for a football match, I could create NFTs, 30,000 NFTs, and those owners of those NFTs could all be individually identified, as in the tokens would be unique. So they're not fungible, they're not exchangeable like for like. They are individual. So you could say this is token number 21F and it corresponds to seat number 21F. And that would be a non-fungible as opposed to a Bitcoin, which is fungible. One Bitcoin is one Bitcoin and always translates to one Bitcoin. So an NFT is a token that is unique to a given property. So it could be given a, like we saw, people attached it to JPEGs and said, okay, this is to this art, or it's attached to this, and it could be attached to a carbon credit, a tree, whatever you want that's unique and individual.
Many people I've spoken to feel ashamed or feel confused about trying to withdraw their crypto investment. Is it difficult to cash it out? Are there admin fees or penalties that hurt consumers?
It would depend on jurisdiction. If you're in the UK, pretty much everything related to crypto is difficult. Anywhere else in the world, it's a pretty straightforward process, and there's very little difficulties.
So, considering the huge energy demands for generating digital assets in this market, environmentally, is it sustainable, especially when you can't physically touch that you're investing in, like a home or a tangible product?
So when you say energy intensive, so a lot of like the crypto mining done in the US, for example, is done out of from flare gas, which is essentially wasted gas. The other set crypto miners are using what would be called excess energy from hydropower or energy that's so crypto is actually in many essences, mining makes the world greener because it takes excess energy or and turns that into productive use cases.
And finally, Ismail, where do you see this industry heading in the future?
So we've seen the rise of stable coins, in sort of approximately $300 billion plus. That should top $1 trillion very soon. You can expect this to become a mainstay of the future economy. We've seen a very, very strong correlation starting to emerge between crypto tokens and AI tokens. AI will be very much a utility that is already tokenized, and it will very soon sort of be crypto tokenized. So you'll be able to purchase it, use of AI with crypto tokens. And if the thesis follows through that AI will become everything, you'll see crypto assets become, if not on par with traditional fiat asset or traditional currency, surpass it.
Thank you, Ismail, for sharing your insights. Let me now move to Matt Saaf Cousin from Gambon. Matt, from a public health perspective, how are crypto and digital assets are being viewed? Are these considered part of the gambling ecosystem?
Yeah, so my software Gamban blocks access to gambling websites and apps on devices. So if people get addicted to gambling, they'll download Gamban, and we work with in the UK the National Gambling Helpline, which is run by Gamcare, and they offer Gamban for free to people that call with problems with gambling. And what we found from insights that we get from the helpline from call volumes was that more and more people were getting addicted to trading crypto. And we then took the decision to also block it because our users are addicted to gambling and crypto because of its volatility and price, because it's a relatively new thing. They were simply displacing what was gambling on conventional gambling sites with the kind of the volatile activity of like trading crypto and day trading, and they were spending a lot of time watching the prices fluctuate and changing their position constantly. So I'm not saying that it's just like gambling, but it has a lot of characteristics that are similar to gambling in terms of like because of the price volatility, and therefore people that are addicted to gambling are vulnerable to that. So we took that decision to protect our users. There are also other things that are kind of classed as a financial service that I would say are much more like gambling, which include, for example, leverage trading platforms where you can bet on the price of a commodity going up or down. I'd say the frictionless nature of some of the platforms where you can even bet. You used to be able to trade leverage on crypto, but like the nature of the platforms that offer the ability to buy and sell cryptocurrency are frictionless, and I think that they are geared towards driving engagement. They're not geared towards long-term holds of particular currencies. I think that's because their interest is in you doing as many trades as possible, so they get the commission. So I think that there's a disalignment between the platforms that offer the ability to sell and buy cryptocurrency and the consumer's interest. The consumer's interest really is buy the crypto, hold it long term, 5 to 10 years, and then it's probably going to go up in value. But because of the volatility and because of the nature of, a person in addiction recovery, if that price starts to go down, they start to panic, they start to sell, they're losing, they're realizing what would otherwise have been paper losses, right? So it's, I think it's not something that I would encourage people to who are in addiction recovery to get involved with because of its volatility. I mean, you might say, for example, well, what's the difference between investing in crypto and investing in stocks and shares? I would say that stocks and shares, if you're talking about index tracker funds or whatever, theoretically, the stock market always goes up long term, and there's a logic that underpins that. And obviously, people need goods and services, otherwise they, to sustain themselves. And the question, that people do ask about crypto is like, what's the underlying value of it? Is it just a speculative asset? And I think Ishmael answered that very well. I mean, I think that there is a lot of potential uses for it, but at the moment, I would say that there's a big risk that people get addicted to it. I think that's happening a lot. I think people are presenting to treatment services with addiction to cryptocurrency. So the other component obviously is the fact that crypto is used by the gambling industry as a mode of currency, and you have the kind of compound effect of the volatility of the price of the crypto, but also the very risky action of gambling on slots and casino content or gambling on sports betting using cryptocurrency. So this is a way that I think a lot of gambling sites, the biggest one is Stake, evade money laundering obligations. They evade payment processor blocking because they're not licensed in particular jurisdictions. So it's definitely being used by criminal elements, I would say, like people that are wanting to evade the jurisdiction of like regulators, or circumvent any kind of blocks there are in a jurisdiction. So better oversight definitely needed of all of that. And obviously, if people, because of the untraceable nature of cryptocurrency, like in terms of it's not going through the conventional banking system, I think it's much easier for platforms like Stake to avoid those kind of money laundering controls, which tend to mean that people can't deposit as much as they otherwise would have, because there would have been a some sort of flag if they're depositing like £2,000. There are rules in place, for example, the EU Money Laundering Directive, where you have to then ask for identification, source of funds, all that sort of stuff. Whereas with crypto, I think when they direct people to their crypto platform, there's not those particular controls because it's cryptocurrency.
We kind of talk about gambling and we're including crypto as part of the gambling process. Could you explain from gambling's point of view, what is gambling? And you yourself a campaigner as well. So is gambling inherently harmful?
Yeah, it's well, gambling, I think, is risking something of value to try to gain something of value. So it doesn't necessarily have to be money for money. It can be something that you're wagering that has value, an intrinsic value, whether that's within the context of a game or whether that's in the context of anything else. So the definition that we have in law of gambling is money or money's worth. In other words, you have to, if you're for it to count as gambling, you can, if you spend money on the activity, but you're not winning something of money that's money or money's worth, i.e. something that can be cashed in for money, then that's not gambling. But I think because we've moved into this digital world now where people are spending lots and lots of money to try to win, a player on Ultimate Team or whatever it is, that has an inherent value to that person. So therefore, I think loot boxes count as a form of gambling, but they're not regulated as such. The position that we take is that we're not anti-gambling. Like if there's demand for something, then that should be catered for in a way that provides a legal opportunity that is safe for the consumer. But we don't think it should be encouraged. We don't think people should be It should be promoted all the time, and we should try and get more people to gamble, more people to engage with things that have quite a significant proportion of people that engage with them are experiencing harm. So, like things like online slots and online casino content, that really should be constrained as much as possible. If people want to do it, that's fine, but it's not something that should be actively promoted as it is in the sector where in the gambling industry, more than half of the profits are coming from online slots, right? On online gambling. So it's a massive sector in terms of like how much revenues it's deriving. It's having a huge impact on the levels of gambling harm, because about 45% of people that engage with slots and casino content online have some degree of a gambling problem. So it's an issue, and it's something that it's not something we should be encouraging. So that's the kind of position that we take. But obviously, if people do it and they get addicted, it's important that they have all of the support if they want to quit. And that's why we wanted to create Gamban, which hopefully helps people stop if they want to.
At what point do you identify there is a genuine problem with the individual with gambling?
Well, I think if you're starting to chase losses, if you're starting to bet more than you plan to, if you're gambling all the time, the frequency I think is a big indicator. So it's a really interesting question, because we hear a lot about from the gambling lobby about the importance of responsible gambling, but no one ever says what that is. What is a responsible consumption of gambling? And I would say that the best estimates are of like low risk gambling guidelines are like one bet a week, which is like not the way that the gambling platforms are geared up. So it's, again, it's the same with the leverage trading apps and I think the crypto exchanges, which want you to change your position and engage more and more and more. It's the same with gambling. They want you to engage more. You might sign up to bet on football, but you're very soon going to get cross promoted to the slots and the casino where you get free spins and inducements and bonuses. And that's where they want you, and they want you to keep engaging as much as possible. The longer you're engaging, the more you'll lose, the more likely you are to get addicted. There's a conditioning effect. They want to create that habit in their users. And then I think the really kind of pernicious thing is when that user eventually loses all the money they have and have access to, then they might self-exclude, and then they just have to just simply replace that customer. There's no long-term relationship that they have with the customers that are driving the majority of the revenues. So 5% of the customers are driving 86% of the revenues. So that 5%, that in that context, they go broke, right? So you need to replace them. So you do that either by changing some of the 95% into the 5%, by getting them to gamble more, trying to get them to engage more, or you find new gamblers, and that's where the advertising comes in. And you have a 6 billion, 7 billion revenues online for gambling each year, and 1.5 billion invested back into marketing. So that's the ecosystem at the moment, and it's, as I say, it's not conducive to long-term customer relationships. And what we would want to see is regulation that kind of slows the pace of the descent into addiction, where customers are signing up, and within a year, they're either bored and they maybe bet once or twice a year, or they're either addicted and they've lost all their money, destroyed their lives, and the gambling industry kind of chews them up, spits them out, and then moves on to the next person. And that's not an industry that we believe should be promoted to people. That's something that should be discouraged if possible.
speaking of the impact that it would have on individuals, their families, and the communities, what do you see?
Oh, well, in the worst cases, people taking their own lives. And there are various estimates of how many people each year do that. But coroners now are starting to ask about gambling and gambling being a factor in suicides. And I think that, we have a male suicide epidemic, and I don't have any doubt, that gambling is a factor in that. Whether that's, the cause or not, I think lots of young people now, young men in particular, who are taking their own lives. There's a brilliant charity called Gambling with Lives, and they support the families that are bereaved by that. And it's just similar stories every time about how it happens. And the industry is not passive in this. And obviously, some of the more extractive practices that they have, the VIP schemes and the cross promoting and the profiling that they do using customer data to try to, time the inducements to get you to gamble, to get you to engage. All of these things all play a part, right? Again, I come back to this thing about responsible consumption. And if an industry is talking about responsible gambling, usually what they mean is they want all their customers to control themselves in a context where they're trying to get them to gamble more than they would have planned, which is kind of a bit of, that's it's incoherent, right? And I think the responsible gambling narrative needs to be flipped on its head. Like, what is responsible consumption? Is the industry doing things that are going to bring that about? And is the industry behaving responsibly? And I think that's the key thing. And unfortunately, we don't have, I think, a regulator that's fit for purpose, really, for the type of for what gambling has evolved into since the 2005 Gambling Act, which is a predominantly online, predominantly mobile sector, which allows people to gamble on products that we had traditionally confined to casinos. Wherever they are, they can now access slots and roulette and blackjack wherever they are. And I just don't think we've got to grips with that and what that means, and the impact of it. And there's, according to the Gambling Survey of Great Britain, there's now 1.3 million people who are problem gamblers. So that's a, significant number. Many more are harmed and many more are affected. So it's a huge issue. And you might not get a lot of people coming out saying, "I've been addicted to gambling," but there is still a stigma associated with it. There's still a, people aren't going to be that forthcoming about it. But we see it. We see it in our user numbers. We see it in the call volumes to the National Gambling Helpline. We see it in the amount of people that are presenting for treatment in the NHS clinics. We're seeing it. We're seeing it in lots of different places, and it's the, it's the same story a lot of the time. And this is what, unfortunately, what the industry runs on. So, as I say, it's not something it should be encouraged.
Matt, from your experience, is there any specific particular group in the UK who are more vulnerable to gambling than others?
Well, until you're 25, the prefrontal cortex does not develop fully. And that is the part of the brain that gauges and regulates behavior and risk. And so when you're young, you are more vulnerable to addiction. If you've got ADHD, or if you've got other mental health issues, of course you're more vulnerable. Now, in the past, you might say, "Oh, well, we'll just protect the vulnerable." But I think everyone's got a vulnerability. I think that there's lots of people that could theoretically get addicted to gambling. I think that it's very much by design. I think that's what the industry either creates or seeks out. They seek those people out, right? They're the high spenders. They're the people driving the revenues. So it's so important that we have a framework for regulating gambling that takes that into account, that understands that there are theoretical moments where anyone across the course of their life may become addicted to gambling, right? Like, if you've had a bereavement, if you're depressed, if you've lost your job, right? There are lots of things that could make a person who otherwise perhaps wouldn't have thought about gambling. I'll tell you what, one a really interesting one of the Parkinson's drugs. So drugs that people take for Parkinson's, right, which I think are dopamine inhibitors or something, they make you want to gamble and they make you addicted to gambling. I mean, that's a thing. So that just shows you how physiological it all is, right? It's even though it's not a substance. So you might at some point in your life have that moment where you get into it and you get addicted to it. So it's important that we have policies that protect everyone.
These days, the focus has been pretty much on kind of responsibility on individuals and their families. What can the companies themselves and the regulators can do to be more effective for those who actually are having difficulties in such times?
The regulator needs to understand the economics of the sector are not conducive to them letting the operators take the lead on this. They can't. Any operator that wants to say we're going to reduce gambling harm will de facto be saying we're going to reduce our profits. That's the nature of the industry. So the regulator has to be the one that says we're going to introduce policies that level the playing field. And for too long, they have relied on it, on self-regulation, on this delusional, I think, assumption that the gambling industry wants to get to a place where it reduces gambling harm. It may well say that. It may well say that in a kind of in a way that a theoretical way, but it's not doing it, and it can't do it. There's no one who's going to be the first mover and say, well, yeah, okay, we'll take the hit on our profits and we'll just displace all those people to other operators. Never going to happen. Regulator needs to be extremely active, needs to have as much information as possible from the operators, needs to ensure that if they have regulations, they are being implemented, that they are being, constantly monitored all the time to ensure compliance. And where they are not compliant, they need to have the power to revoke licenses. At the moment, they do have that theoretical power, but they don't really, if you look at it in practice, it's very, very difficult for them to do that. So for me, a regulator should have the power to issue licenses at their discretion and revoke them at their discretion. And that's the way you get operators to be compliant, because if you get on the wrong side of the regulator, then you're in trouble. And at the moment, we've got a regulator who is compelled to issue licenses because there is an aim to permit requirement in the Gambling Act 2005. And it's very, very difficult to revoke them. So they end up issuing fines, which are basically a cost of doing business for the sector. So you don't get that change. It doesn't catalyze the change that's needed.
Kind of going back to the individual, really. So when we find ourselves in that situation, what sort of support can they get from service providers?
So I would encourage people to download Gamban, obviously, which blocks access to gambling websites and apps on their devices. They can get that for free through talkbanstop.com. On there also, you'll see opportunities to speak to the National Gambling Helpline, to speak to advisors about where to go for additional support. There's also signposting to GamStop, which is the self-exclusion register for the UK. And there's also recommendations for switching on the bank transaction block. So many banks offer this now, which is great. You switch on the transaction block, and then if you want to deposit to a gambling site, it won't let you. And if you want to switch off the transaction block, it will take a calling off period before you're allowed to do that. So Monzo's is excellent. I think you can actually set your calling off period now, so you can actually say a year or something. And then if you wanted to switch it off, then you're not going to be able to like quickly. So there are lots of things you can do, and it's important that you layer it up. So when you have that urge to gamble, which will come, it's too difficult, and then the urge passes.
Moving on to the mental health side that you mentioned, Matt, quite a few times actually. So now a number of supports that are available. One of them is the cognitive behavioral therapy. How can that help? Does it help at all?
Yeah, it does. So it helps you frame what something means to you in your mind. So it enables you the that gives you the tools to kind of understand that something that you're doing that you perceive to be a good thing or a release or where something that's positive or is actually very, very negative. And obviously what the addiction will do is it will change your perception of something that is harming you because it wants you to do that thing. I'm talking about the addiction as if it's like a thing, right? Like a person. That's what it does. It corrupts your perceptions. And cognitive behavioral therapy is a way of unpicking all of that, disentangling all of it. It's very, very good. There are other therapies as well. Motivational interviewing. There's mindfulness therapy. Just all of these things are helpful with recalibrating what gambling means to you and dealing with the urges to gamble and understanding them and where they're coming from and the triggers and helping you rebuild yourself as well, because it's quite trauma. If you've been at rock bottom with a gambling addiction and you've lost everything and you may have had relationship breakdowns and you may have lost your job or whatever, it's very traumatic. It's a traumatizing descent into rock bottom, and you need a bit of support, I think, after to rebuild yourself. Otherwise, you're at risk, more risk of relapse. So yeah, it's really, really helpful. It's really important. So I think it, in recovery, once you quit gambling, it's quite difficult mentally. It does leave a hole in your life. So I think you need to figure out how to fill that time productively. And yeah, I think obviously when you're gambling, it's almost like you're medicating yourself in a way to be able to kind of shut out all the problems that gambling has caused. So if you can't gamble, you're kind of there facing the problems, without any kind of way to medicate yourself. And the therapy is important, I think, there as well.
In terms of your product, how does it work?
So people, when they want to quit gambling, will download it onto all of their devices, and it will block access to the gambling websites and apps. So we've got over 280,000 websites and apps on the block list globally, and we're adding about 300 a day. So that's the scale of it, right? It's crazy. We've got all sorts of systems that can detect the sites when they emerge, and we've got systems that can curate the block list so we're not over blocking. But it's designed to be difficult to remove. So if you select the 1 year license, your Gamban protection will be on your device for a year. If you try to get rid of it, it would be very, very difficult for you to do that. And the point is to create as much friction as possible. So when you do want to gamble, you can't. We have basically irremovable versions on most platforms, and next month we will have them on all platforms. We're launching a new version on iPhones, which has historically been a real challenge because of the restrictive nature of the operating system on iPhones, on iOS. But this is we found a way of making it irremovable. We're very excited about that. I think that's a bit of a breakthrough for us. But as well as the blocking, we've got all sorts of different features on the app. So you can track how much money you've saved, you can track how much time you've saved and the days since you gambled, and there's lots of links to support and other services in that particular jurisdiction. It's localized wherever you are in the world, and obviously it works wherever you are in the world as well. So that's the key difference between Gamban and GamStop, is that we would cover the black market, and we would cover anywhere you went in the world, your device would be blocked from gambling.
Can I just bring up, we had a site called pump.fun. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. And the reason it's been ISP blocked from the EU or and the UK is because it was deemed a speculative gambling type of crypto endeavor, right? Which was, maybe you're familiar with it. It came out of the meme stocks and meme coins sort of ethos. Is a similar move not by default, like you would do if I signed up for T-Mobile and it would say I would need to get a to be unblocked to be able to access 18 plus. Can you not just do it at the ISP level? Or why have they not just done the same measures they do for crypto for gambling? Where's the Discord? Is the gambling got a much bigger lobby that is able to get, lots more dispensations than the crypto lobby? Why such a light heart for the gambling industry?
You make a very good point, and I think one of the interesting dynamics in gambling policy discourse is the gambling lobby's constant reversion to saying that we can't overregulate the sector because of the black market. And my argument to that is the way you deal with the black market and criminal enterprises is by going after the people behind them, not treating it as a an issue of internet regulation, but as a criminal issue. These are criminals who are effectively laundering proceeds of crime, and it needs to be treated with that seriousness. And in any case, what you're saying is correct. You can do much more at ISP level, blocking all the illegal gambling websites. In the same way, the ISPs block access to people who are selling arms online, or drugs, or people trafficking, or whatever it might be. Right? There are lots of things that aren't accessible on the internet. So this idea that we can't regulate the internet is, I think, outdated, and there are many contexts within which that happens. But the gambling industry, for me, are not. If they wanted solutions to the black market, they would have lobbied for them in the same way that we do. We think that is, there's lots more that the regulator could do. But what they want is almost to use the black market as a reason to drive down regulation in it in the licensed sector. So it's interesting dynamics, I would say, but yeah, there's way more that can be done.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Ismail, for giving your kind of insight into it. Now, let me just go back to actually Ismail for and Matt for giving top tips to DebtTalk listeners who are struggling with gambling harm, crypto and digital assets. Let me start with Ismail. What top tips would you give to DebtTalk listeners?
I would demarcate. So what we had was there was an industry called binary options, and that industry was largely where you would bet over a period of 60 seconds or 3 minutes or maybe even less, and whether the stock was going to go up or down. So essentially a bet, you press a green or a red button. That was largely outlawed, marginalized, regulated out of the finance industry. Those same actors re-emerged and started to use crypto and started to put those same similar toolkits on essentially what is gambling into the crypto sector. And now you've got this kind of quite dangerous merging of the banned and shady world of gaming, gambling, and often masqueraded as social gaming or whatever it may be, terminology to sort of make it less forthright in what it actually is now, sort of grabbing on to crypto and leveraging crypto to be the sort of toolkit to access these services. So my advice would be, if you spot one of these and find one of these, contact your local MP and ask for him to raise it as a point of order in the Commons, and have it noted down in the Hansard. There's a corpus of written complaints that can have an FOI on there. Anything short of a public swell that, calls out sort of gamified gambling and this association with crypto is not going to really get a serious sort of
any legislation to sort of block it or ban it or prevent it in anytime soon. So it really needs to be a groundswell of either watchful or citizens or those. And I would especially reach out to anybody who's been or had a family member or been themselves, you know, involved in some form of problem gambling or gambling with crypto, to identify, make a log of all what they've seen, and submit that to the local MP to take it up in the Commons.
And finally, Matt from Gambon.
So if you feel like you're gambling too much, or you want to quit, then head to talkbanstop.com if you're in the UK, and you'll find lots of tools and support there, including free Gamban licenses. And it's important that you layer up as much protection as possible. So when you do have the urge to gamble, it's very, very difficult. And know that there's lots of support now for people who get addicted to gambling. There's lots of very, very effective treatment out there. There's now, I think, 13 NHS clinics across the country just specialised in gambling addiction treatment. So there's lots of support there. And, you know, when you're in the middle of a gambling addiction and you feel like you need to, when your loss is back, or you want to keep gambling or whatever it is, the urge to gamble goes, and you can be much happier without it. You can leave it behind and rebuild. And I would encourage anyone who's experiencing harm from gambling to think about doing that, because it's important that if you start to experience harm, that you quit as quickly as possible, rather than once you've lost everything. Yeah, that's it, really.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Ismail. By the way, I'm very grateful for your input. Without your input, DebtTalk wouldn't be where it is. And DebtTalk received a wealth of feedback, really, on Spotify, especially. On the next episode of DebtTalk, we'll be exploring cars and their costs, another critical issue affecting our communities. Thank you for listening to DebtTalk podcast. I'm your host, Ripon Ray. Until next time.